This is an ABC podcast.
This is the WA Country Hour on ABC Radio WA.
Hello, how are you going? I am Kate Forrester. Lovely to be with you this Wednesday afternoon across the state. Well, shortly, we're going to try to find out who offered the advice to the state government that led to the permanent closure of some of our oceans to commercial fishing of demersal species. And Shadow Fisheries Minister Kiralee Waugh is actually calling for an inquiry.
We're simply asking, is this the captain's call? The little detail that has followed since these announcements is quite concerning. Industry is reeling from some of the most wide-sweeping announcements and changes in their industry that they've seen, yet a week on, there is no detail around what that will mean for them.
So all of that coming up after the news at 12:30, also after we've checked in on the weather and rainfall across the state. It is 12:06 here on the Country Hour. Well, first up today, Spud Shed has started its own line of milk, and that's upset WA dairy farmers. Now, Spud Shed is owned and run by the Gilardi family and is renowned for selling fresh produce at affordable prices. We understand Spud Shed is sourcing its milk through the Bega Group. Ian Noakes is president of the WA Farmers Dairy Council. Ian, what do you know about all of this?
All I know is they've launched their own brand of milk and at the same price as what everybody wants to give it away for. I think farmers, dairy farmers, who just throw their hands in the air and say, how much longer do we have to be a charity organisation for supermarkets and people that want to sell discount milk? There wouldn't be a dairy farmer that likes the idea of their produce that worked so hard to make high quality produce and then sold in supermarkets and things like the Spud Shed for prices that are unsustainable for the industry. And that unsustainability is there, right there to see, is that we now drop below 100 farmers in Western Australia, dairy farmers in Western Australia. Milk production's down. I would say we're in for a squeeze for milk supply this summer. And if we actually on farm don't get a price rise soon, there'll be a lot more people going out. And so I'm disgusted that somebody that purports to support farmers actually, then sells it at a discount price.
What is your understanding about where this milk is being sourced from?
As far as I know, Bega has got the contract. They're based in Bentley and they buy their farms off West Australian. They buy their milk off West Australian farmers between south of Perth down to about Busselton. I think most of they might have a couple of, I think Bega contract a couple of people in Northcliffe.
Okay, so is it in a way, though, I don't know, I'm just trying to look at it from the other way here, that it's good that we are supporting local, we're not going over to the eastern states?
If they don't start paying the farmers a decent price, that's where our milk will be coming from. So it's not going to sell any more milk, it's just giving it away at a lower price.
How much is the milk being retailed for?
My understanding, about $1.60 or so a litre, which might add, that milk price is nowhere in the world sells their milk cheaper than that.
So how serious is this for your industry when we have prices like that?
Yeah, it is serious. I mean, it's obvious what's going on. We've dropped from not so many years ago, sort of 380 million litres, and this year I predict we'll probably go under 320 million. That's where it's heading anyway. That's a pretty significant drop. I think we're at the stage now where it's starting to become critical that we haven't got enough buffer in there to make sure that we can supply fresh products all year round. Yeah, it's frustrating. In fact, we had an industry planning group meeting last week and we expressed those feelings pretty strongly that the time has come to actually do something. I think the milk price on farm needs to be 80 cents a litre. It needs to be there very quickly.
Do you think this kind of pricing is more about drawing customers into the store rather than supporting farmers?
Yeah, absolutely. And so one of the things that Coles said when they brought in a dollar a litre of milk all those years ago was, we'll sell more milk. Well, the fact of the matter is people buy a certain amount of milk and they don't buy any more. So it's just taking more money out of the supply, the chain, if you like. So the processors can't get enough profit, they don't pass it on to farmers. And so I don't understand in this state where we are with milk production why any processor would sell, you know, why are you signing these contracts at prices that are not sustainable for the whole industry?
As the president of WA Farmers Dairy, have you had any conversations directly with the Gulati Group about these plans?
No, I didn't know anything about it until last week. And I don't see what the point would be, you know. They brought in their own milk, selling at a discount price. So it is what it is. We know with discussions with the main supermarkets about milk pricing and stop, you know, the home brand milk, that it makes no difference. So, you know, I've got a word for them, but I won't say it.
All right, Ian. Well, it's good to get your thoughts. Thank you so much for your time on the Country Hour.
Okay.
Ian Noakes is president of the WA Farmers Dairy Council. And I have put in a request to speak to Spudshed and the Gladys and also to Bega on this launch. I am yet to hear back, though, so hopefully I will soon and bring it as soon as I get that. 11 past 12 on the Country Hour.
The WA Country Hour on ABC Radio WA.
Well, Australian beekeepers have funded an investigation into the authenticity of imported honey on supermarket shelves, with early results showing some imports are not pure. Now, the industry tested 30 products and some showed signs of adulteration. Chair of the Australian Honeybee Industry Council, John Lockwood, says the industry is on a mission to modernise Australia's testing standards.
We were lucky enough, a few good beekeepers donated enough money and we did a bit of a survey off the shelf and got some honey off the supermarkets and got it tested in Germany.
And John, do you have results that you can share on what that testing found?
So not specific brands. We're not after a witch hunt here. We're just trying to paint a bit of a picture of what's happening with the honey coming into Australia to give us a bit more of an understanding. So what we've done, we've taken that data to the federal government or DAF, and we're working with DAF very closely to demonstrate what we're finding with the imported honey coming into Australia.
Can you give us, I guess, a sense of the amount of tests that you ran and the amount that showed that the honey was adulterated in some form?
Yeah, we only did a broad sweep. We only did about 30, and we found a few honeys that had been pre-packed before they were imported into Australia that showed that they were adulterated. So our end goal here is to show DAF that perhaps some of this honey is getting slipping through the cracks with their current testing protocol, and that testing protocol needs to be examined and brought up to the modern day era.
From what you're saying, the testing that is done with DAF and the testing that the industry paid for done in Germany, they're quite different by the sound of things. So what are those differences?
Yeah, that's correct. So the current testing protocol to import honey is very, very outdated. It's simply what's called a C4 test, moisture and reducing sugars. So it's not very comprehensive whatsoever, as opposed to some more modern techniques that can be used around the world, which we'd love to see adopted here in Australia.
When we say adulterated honey, what can be in it?
Quite often, so this isn't just an Australian problem. This is a massive problem. Internationally, honey is one of the most adulterated products globally, and it's often adulterated with sugar syrups or rice syrups, particularly coming out of Asian countries.
And is the problem with the testing that's currently done, the Australian standard testing, that it doesn't pick up some of the products that it can be mixed with, say rice syrup?
Yeah, that is a problem, which again isn't particularly Australia's problem solely. It's a very grey area internationally how to detect a pure honey.
Is there a level of adulteration that is acceptable with honey coming in, like a level of, I don't know, sugar in the product that is allowed?
No, absolutely not. So any honey should only be produced from the bee. That's what we really need to advocate for. And we're really just trying to give our Australian beekeepers a level playing field to operate in the market.
And what's it like, John? You're a beekeeper yourself. You're working hard. You're producing this beautiful product and you're competing with an imported product, and that imported product is potentially not pure honey. How does all that stack?
Oh, well, yeah, I think I speak for most beekeepers here. It's not very, it doesn't sit very well with the guy on the ground. We'd like to see, yeah, a fair playing field, and Australian honey is the best honey in the world. It's very pure. We produce it from pristine landscapes, and, yeah, we need to get our best value for that product.
And for the consumer, how do they ensure that what they're eating is actually honey?
The consumer, the biggest thing that they can do for the Australian industry and ensure that their honey is pure is to ensure that it's 100% Australian honey. So look on the back of the label, 100% Australian, and it's not mixed with any imported honey whatsoever. And that would give the Australian beekeeper a great advantage. You know, we need to bring back into our minds why it's so important to have bees, and that's pollination. So one out of every three mouthfuls of food we consume is directly impacted by honeybees pollinating that crop. So by buying Australian honey, we're really supporting the beekeeper and therefore food security.
Chair of the Australian Honeybee Industry Council, John Lockwood, speaking to Joe Prendergast. And in a statement, DAFF said the department is conducting a pilot survey to assess the authenticity of imported honey samples and compare the department's current border tests with the performance of commercially available analytical tests. The results of this survey will inform if further work is required to update our testing capability at the border. Imported honey samples are analysed using internationally accepted standard methods for detecting adulterated honey. And if you want to read more about this online, you can do so. Just search ABC Rural and Honey. That's ABC Rural and Honey, and you will find Joe's story all about this there. 17 past 12. Well, canola has been the standout crop in recent years, delivering some of the best returns that grain growers have ever seen. And I'd say you'd probably remember back to those extraordinary 2020 through to 2023 season prices when they shot past $1,000 a tonne. Now, a few years on from that, a question you might be thinking is, will we ever see historical highs like that again? Well, Andrew Whitelaw is a global grain market analyst. Andrew, you can answer that for me. Will we ever see those prices come through again?
Yeah, I think we probably will see these prices again. They're above $1,000 a ton. It's the case of when. I don't think it's going to be soon. I don't think it's going to be this season, but in the future, I think we will see them. And it's the question we get asked all the time is, you know, as farmers, we deserve $1,000 a ton because the market could pay $1,000 a ton. You know, back in 2021 through to the sort of 2023, that's when they had that really high peak in canola pricing. But the reality is markets don't operate that way. They don't operate on, we paid this much once, we can pay it again. They work on supply and demand. And that's what drives it. Again, what I would say, just to highlight things, is that if we look sort of pre-COVID, you know, the price, an Australian average price for canola, you know, it used to trade between 450 and 600, and now we're sort of trading between sort of 700 and 900 in this sort of post-peak period. But, you know, if we look at it from a point of view of what caused that peak, because that really tells you why it won't get to 1,000 at present based on the current market. You know, we got to over $1,000 a ton because we had a number of different factors. They all sort of came about at the same time, pretty much. We had Canada having its worst crop in over a decade for canola. Canada's the biggest exporter of canola in the world. Secondly, we had the Ukraine war that coincided. Ukraine, Russia combined exports about 20% of the world's canola. So you got two major suppliers with major issues. And then thirdly, you had, you know, obviously the Ukraine war pumped up energy prices. And when energy prices rise, grain and oilseed prices tend to rise as well. But if we look conversely at this year, you know, we've got the Ukrainian war, whilst it still continues, oil seeds and grains are still getting exported in large volumes. Canada having a record crop, Australia having the second highest crop, and energy prices starting to decline. So you've got sort of very different environment to what you had when the peak was over $1,000 a ton.
Yeah, so like even at these lower levels, we can still say that prices, they're historically pretty good.
Absolutely, historically very good. And we are sitting in that trading in that band, which is a lot higher than it sort of previously had been. Obviously, we do have higher costs, fuel, fertilizer, labor, insurance have all become a lot more expensive, but they are considerably higher than they were prior to that sort of really strong peak in the early part of this decade.
You mentioned earlier Canada. Pre-COVID, they were experiencing one of their worst crops. Now, a few years on, they're looking, well, they're forecasting a 21.8 million tonne crop. How big of a deal is that for global prices and the Australian market?
Look, it is a huge issue. Canada is the largest exporter of canola in the world. And it's probably a bigger issue for things like our GM canola, because we have that sort of quite a large spread between GM and non-GM at the moment. And largely a big chunk of that is coming from the fact that China and Canada have got their own little diplomatic stoush at the moment. And so they are not able to trade canola seed into China at the moment, which means that they, with that GM canola, they're competing into a lot of the other destinations we would send to. However, on the flip side of that, since Canada lost access to China, we have now got access to China. But Canada is definitely instrumental in setting direction, because they are, you know, such a significant exporter. We're the second largest exporter. You know, Canada exports multiple times the volume that we export.
Mm. Just on that, Australia going into China, there was that shipment that left Esperance earlier in November. Have you heard if that's arrived and how that's ended up going?
No, I haven't sort of looked any further than having left. We know that there's vessels that have been booked, and we know that this tonnage being bought. But I think, you know, as soon as China lost access to Canada, effectively, we knew that they were going to have to come to Australia, because really their only choice was Ukraine or Australia. And obviously shipping from Australia is better. And finances counteract, you know, the supposed blackleg issue that China had. I think we will be doing good volume, because prior to 2020, when that blackleg sort of ban came about, we were doing sort of at times, you know, 20% of our canola would go to China. And frankly, like as analysts, we look at Europe as being a big risk for canola, because at times we're doing, you know, 60% plus of our canola will go to Europe. So diversifying our markets is pretty important.
This is the WA Country Hour. It is 23 past 12. I'm chatting to Andrew Whitelaw from Episode 3, who is a global grain market analyst, just on the prices we're seeing for canola and what's influencing those this year. And do be part of the program today. If you're a grower, what do you make of this year's prices versus what you saw a few years ago? The text line today is 0448 922 604. Andrew, let's now move to look at energy prices. We have seen energy prices slide the past few weeks. What is driving that fall, and how quickly do you think we're going to see that shift flow into the canola market?
Well, interestingly, we're not really seeing it at the petrol station yet, but we are seeing energy prices, like gas prices, crude oil prices, are dropping around the world. And largely that's a sort of a symptom of a bit of oversupply, but also concerns about global growth. It's really quite interesting. When you look at sort of grains and oil seeds and, say, crude oil, they have quite a strong correlation of following one another. And largely that's because of the fact that significant quantities of our grains and oil seeds are used to make biofuels, but also, you know, it's extremely energy intensive to produce crops. Because, you know, production of fertilizer, chemicals, diesel for actually planting and harvesting is a fairly energy intensive process. And that's all we're really doing, is converting energy to food. And so what we're seeing is, you know, that is a concern over the next year or so. If energy prices drop, then it means biodiesel prices drop. And if biodiesel prices drop, it reduces that sort of demand for biofuels.
Well, we're seeing a lot of investment and interest in WA and across Australia in sustainable aviation fuel, which does make sense since we are the biggest canola producing state. Could we see a bit of a two-speed economy here as some of those projects do come into stream?
Look, I think the options for growing a biofuels industry in Australia are extremely beneficial to Australian producers. I know I speak to farmers a lot of the time, and a lot of farmers are dubious of it because it's a policy from Labor. But I think people should, ignore that fact and just understand the fact that a biofuels industry domestically in Australia would be absolutely fantastic news for Australian producers, because one, it makes a market for our product, whether it's canola, whether it's sorghum, whether it's sugar. It could be any number of sort of different commodities that are converted into biofuels. But the reality is what it makes is a market that's not dictated as much by overseas events. So it could create, a new market, a new domestic market. And it's a good news story because at the end of the day, we already are dictated. Our prices for canola, our prices for wheat, to an extent, our barley prices, a huge chunk of those prices are dictated by biofuels policies. They just happen to be in other parts of the world. Like all of our canola pretty much goes into biofuels anyway. The difference is now that if we get a biofuels industry in Australia, we'll be involved in an Australian biofuels market and not as much a European biofuels market. So we're already, all of our prices are underpinned by biofuels anyway, just not biofuels within Australia.
Andrew, good to get your thoughts today on the Country Hour. Thank you for your time.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
Andrew Whitelaw is a global grain market analyst with Episode 3. And he was just giving some commentary around canola prices this year and what's driving those globally. And he was just saying that a lot of Australian farmers that he has spoken to in the past, he used the word dubious about having their own biofuels industry here domestically. Are you in that category? How do you feel about our own biofuels industry? Let me know on the text line 0448 922 604.
You're listening to the WA Country Hour on ABC Radio WA.
We are coming up to the news headlines at 12:30, but winners of our annual Haywire storytelling competition have just been announced today, with young people from across the country sharing candid accounts of what life is like beyond capital cities.
Hey, I'm Hardy from the Prongra.
Hey, I'm Justice from Perenjori.
I'm Hayley from Mulija Community.
Hi, I'm Kaz from Bunbury.
Hey, I'm Fabian from Wanaham Point, Bari Jawi Country.
When I got the call to say I was a Haywire winner, I was very surprised.
I really didn't think I was gonna be a winner.
I was actually gobsmacked. I didn't actually think that my story would get me to this point.
So excited to go travel to Canberra, get to meet all the other winners. Yeah, really cool. Really excited.
I felt very happy and excited and very proud of myself because I did this for my family.
I didn't really win a lot of competitions like this. And this is a big one as well. And I really didn't think I would be able to.
My Haywire story is about my experience being transgender and growing up around other people that maybe just didn't understand how that worked.
My Haywire story is about how good stand-up comedy is. I think it's the perfect art form. Because I was like, there's nothing to do in Albany to do with comedy. But then I realized you can really do a lot. And then I start to do more with my local community. And it's really good and I really enjoy it.
It's about me and what I love, where I'm from, and kind of my story through music and my song.
My Haywire story is about when Cyclone Seroja came through Perenjori in 2021 and all the damage that it's done to Perenjori and also to me.
That was Justice from the Midwest here in Western Australia. And don't go anywhere, because coming up after the 4-day weather forecast, you are going to hear Justice's story. But now we're going to hear the headlines with Jonathan Beale.
Thanks, Kate. Police have charged another three teenagers over an attack in Ellenbrook, which left a 15-year-old boy with stab wounds. The trio face a number of charges, including unlawful wounding and being armed in a way that may cause fear. A total of 9 juveniles have now been charged over the incident at Ellenbrook Secondary College on Monday afternoon. The Health Minister, Meredith Hammett, says a trial involving the use of artificial intelligence at one of Perth's biggest hospitals will not take decision-making out of the hands of clinicians. The pilot program, which will get underway at Royal Perth Hospital for the 2026 winter season, will use AI to schedule and perform tasks like laboratory tests, medical imaging, and discharge summaries. If the trial is successful, the program will be rolled out at other WA hospitals. And the state opposition's fisheries spokeswoman, Kiralee Waugh, has accused the government of being heavy-handed by imposing a permanent ban on commercial demersal fishing when modelling shows stocks will recover within 15 years. The Fisheries Minister, Jackie Jarvis, says modelling by the Department of Primary Industries and Regional Development shows stock would recover by 2040 under full closure. Ms Waugh has called for a more detailed explanation of why the ban is permanent. More news, Kate, at 1 o'clock.
Thank you, Jonathan. And you are very shortly going to hear from the Opposition Fisheries Minister, Kiralee Waugh, more on the demersal fishing ban. And on the text line, Michael has texted in to say, can we please find out if other fishing zones, i.e. the South Coast bag limits and boat limits, are going to be reduced in unison to allow for the added pressure they will come under from West Coast fishers? And if not, why not? We don't want to just move one problem to another fishery. Thank you for your thoughts, Michael. Text line is 0448 922 604 if you want to text in and have your say. And it's a really good question Michael just raised, because in a moment we're going to see if that is answered by the people we're hearing from in the fishing industry. But now we're going to move on to the weather with Caroline Crowe. Caroline, let's start in the Southwest Land Division this afternoon. What is going on?
Good afternoon. So fairly quiet during the Southwest Land Division today. So just a touch of cloud along the south coast near Albany and Bremer Bay, but otherwise sunny throughout the Southwest Land Division. We're going to have some weather though, and thunderstorms be the main story for the coming next 4 days through to the weekend and actually into early next week as well. So the main part is that there is a trough. It's just inland from the west coast. It's going to kind of linger and then move back towards the west coast towards the weekend and bring some hotter weather and some thunderstorms with it. So with the trough just being inland from the west coast coming into Thursday, we've got showers and thunderstorms forecast for central or inland parts of the Southwest Land Division, so away from the west coast. If I could try and guide the area by some locations, so south of around Dalwallinu to Beacon, and then east of, like, following Dalwallinu, like, including, so to Mora, down to Collie, around towards the south coast, but not including the south coast, and towards the Esperance area. So it doesn't include the south coast, just inland from the south coast, and it's kind of pocketed by that area there. There is a little pocket through the inland parts near Muckenbuden, Meriden, Caliberin, that actually look as though there are a lower chance of getting a thunderstorm tomorrow, but otherwise it's sort of bounded by that area. Also over coming into Thursday, little or no rainfall forecast with the thunderstorms, and they could be gusty at times as well. And then coming into Friday, that trough just shuffles a little bit further east, so we do see that area just shuffle a little bit further east with the trough. So the area of the thunderstorms is more bounded by sort of looking at an area from around Morowa to Carnamar, including Mora and then Cunderdon towards the south coast, so east of that line there. The thunderstorms in the south, though, south of around Corrigan to Hyden and east of that area that I mentioned, and particularly through the southeast coastal district, so Esperance, Salmon Gums, the Ravensthorpe area, actually might be more overnight Thursday into Friday morning, and then on Friday they gradually contract east and clear. Those thunderstorms may have a little bit of rainfall with them, so possibly 2 to 5, maybe 10 mils with an isolated, slightly heavier fall. The thunderstorms in the remaining area that I mentioned are likely to have little or no rainfall with them, and are more likely to be the afternoon thunderstorms associated with the surface trough. And then coming into Saturday, we see that surface trough move a little bit further north, so the southern districts of the Southwest Land Division should be clear from thunderstorms on Saturday, and the thunderstorms confined more to the central and northern parts of the Southwest Land Division. So drawing a line from around north of Hyden to Perth, but not including Perth, is the area of thunderstorms. Once again, little to no rainfall with the thunderstorms on Saturday. And then on Sunday, we see that trough really right close to the west coast, or just off the west coast, and drags all the thunderstorms right down to the south coast. Particularly in that southwest corner of from about, so if we draw a line from about Ravensthorpe to the south coast, that's the area of thunderstorms west of that line, so not including the Esperance and most of the southeast coastal district on Sunday, and just away from the coastal fringe around that Windy Harbour, Walpole area. But otherwise, north of that line is where our thunderstorms are, and the thunderstorms in the central west district coming into Sunday could have 1 to 3 millimetres of rainfall with it, might get the odd one, which has a touch more. But otherwise, most of the thunderstorms, once again, are likely to have little or no rainfall with it. The other thing with the trough being in the area is that we're going to have some windy conditions at times, and also quite a bit of heat through the Southwest Land Division. So coming into Thursday, some of those northeastern inland parts is probably the hottest day for the next couple of days, albeit it is still going to remain quite hot to very hot. And we'll see that heat gradually get pushed down the south coast and, down the west coast and into southern parts as well coming into the weekend. So getting well above average for parts of the Southwest Land Division. With that wind and heat also, we are seeing some elevated fire danger ratings, possibly reaching extreme in some parts, more the northwestern parts of the Southwest Land Division. So just watch out for the possible fire weather warnings associated with those fire danger ratings, and we may see some heatwave conditions developing later in the week with that heat progressing right down to the south coast, Kate.
Well, talking about heat, if we move up to the northern and eastern forecast districts, it is still very hot up there.
Correct. It is. It is. We are going to see a couple of degrees drop coming over the next couple of days. So we do have that severe heatwave conditions, which we've been seeing over the last few days as well. But it does look as though we're going to start seeing a little bit of that ease off over the next couple of days as we move into the later part of the week. So it starts to move just a little bit south, and there's those severe heatwave conditions do gradually ease as we progress towards the end of the week and into the weekend as well. So hopefully a little bit of relief coming through those northern parts, Kate.
Fingers crossed for them, Caroline. Thank you so much.
Cheers.
Richard Hudson is here with the rainfall figures.
Yeah, not too much to get through again. It's mostly in the Kimberley. Curtin Airport had 18 mils, Fitzroy Crossing 28, Gogo Station 9, Kununurra and Mount Amherst 5 mils, Mount House Airstrip 44, Mount Krause 13, Mount Winifred 8, Parry Creek Farm 14, Udialla 10 and Yulumbu had 14. And then in the Pilbara, Indy had a little bit of a downpour with 8 mils, but nowhere else in the state had any real rain of significance. But Kate, as you mentioned earlier, and Bilo just mentioned it now, fishing's obviously still a pretty hot topic, not surprising after those big announcements. But some people in the commercial fishing industry are wondering who advised the State Fisheries Minister, Jackie Jarvis, to take such drastic measures to replenish demersal fish stocks. So this obviously follows last week's announcement that there's going to be a permanent ban on catching demersal fish such as jewfish, pink snapper and red emperor right in along the West Coast regions, all the way from Kalbarri to Augusta, and there's also a permanent closure to trawlers in the Pilbara. Well, on this topic, Nationals MLC Rob Hortzman posed a few questions to Minister Jarvis in Parliament last night.
I refer to the advice provided by the Department of Primary Industries and Regional Development, DPIRD, to the Minister ahead of the announcement of the demersal fishing ban in the West Coast bioregion, and I ask, one, what was the recommendation DPIRD provided to the Minister regarding demersal fishing? Two, how long was the closure recommended by DPIRD for? And three, what key data underpin this advice?
Minister for Fisheries.
Thank you, President. Thank you, Members. No, it's the question. One to two. DPIRD provided advice based on the most recent scientific assessments and relevant harvest strategy for the West Coast demersal scale fish resource. The assessments indicated a 100% reduction to recovery benchmarks. Fishing closure was required to recover stocks and target levels by 2040. Three, resource assessment report number two, West Coast Demersal Scale Fish Resource 2025 Assessment and Fisheries Management Paper number 305, West Coast Demersal Scale Fish Resource Harvest Strategy 2021-2025.
Don't know about you, but I struggle to sort of comprehend it all when it's just three questions rattled off, three answers all in a row. It's just bang, 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 bang. So let's just slow it down a bit. The key question from Rob Hortzman was number two, how long was the closure recommended by DPIRD for? Let's just listen to the answer again.
The assessments indicated a 100% reduction to recovery benchmarks. Fishing closure was required to recover stocks and target levels by 2040.
You can make up your own mind if that answers the question. But this morning, Premier Roger Cook was asked about this on Nadia Mitsopoulos' morning show.
With the total ban on commercial demersal fishing in that region, Kalbarri to Augusta, was there any advice that a temporary ban until 2040 would have been sufficient for stocks to recover? Was that also presented to you?
Well, we talked about a whole range of issues. Remember, we actually brought the science out some months ago. We had our future fishing forum, which we held at Parliament House with all the stakeholders and industry representatives to make sure that we were informed of all the opportunities that were before us in relation to the decisions that we made.
And that was an option presented to you?
Well, I don't know if that was one of the specific options, but obviously we considered a whole range of responses to what is a severely low situation with regard to that particular bias.
And that would have included a temporary ban of 10 or 15 years or a permanent ban.
That's right. We looked at a range of things. And what we're trying to do, of course, Nadia, is balance the conservation issues that we have here against the recreational fishers' interests, against the commercial fishers' interests, and, of course, industry-wide. So, and these are tough decisions, but we've made it on behalf of future generations of Western Australians.
Now, I'm not 100% certain that was a completely definitive answer from the Premier regarding what the exact recommendations were and who they came from. The reason I'm highlighting this is it's actually come to my attention that late last week, commercial fishing operators met with DPIRD fisheries staff to discuss implications for the South Coast. Now, during that meeting, one operator asked DPIRD staff the following question with this preamble. Regarding the permanent closure of fishing for demersal species to Pilbara trawlers and to the commercial operators in the West Coast region from Kalbarri to Augusta, the minister must have acted upon advice from someone or some department. Just wondering who offered the advice for those to be permanent closures. So after emphasising the word permanent, the reply came back from a DPIRD staff member. It was not DPIRD's recommendation to permanently close either of those commercial fishing areas. Now, I understand Recfish West wasn't calling for a permanent closure to commercial operators either. It was definitely calling for drastic action, but I understand Recfish West would have been quite happy for temporary closures of various lengths in different areas, you know, right across the board. Anyway, Shadow Fisheries Minister Kiralee Waugh is, again, calling for an inquiry into fisheries, and she wants the state government to come clean on exactly who gave them the advice to permanently close some commercial fisheries to demersal fish.
We're calling for the minister to table the recommendations that were given to her by the scientists themselves. Last night in Parliament, there was certainly no indication that a time-limited closure was the requirement for the recovery of the demersal scale fish in West Australia.
Are you saying that the Minister has not acted on the advice of DPIRD?
We're simply asking, is this the captain's call? The little detail that has followed since these announcements is quite concerning. Industry is reeling from some of the most wide-sweeping announcements and changes in their industry that they've seen, yet a week on, there is no detail around what that will mean for them. We're asking for the Minister to front up to the industry and table those recommendations and give us some detail around what it would be in terms of compensation, what it will mean for all of those fishers and operators and regional communities that have been decimated by this announcement.
You might say, though, why would a fisheries minister close a fishery indefinitely if she didn't have to? Because politically it's unsavoury. Why do it?
Well, that's the question we asked last night, Joe, and that's why we are saying, is this a captain's call? Because we have the assessment reports, we've read those assessment reports, and that is the science that is available to us right now. But what we are also asking for is an inquiry into fisheries, because we understand that there is more than just catch and fisheries management around the stock levels. There are other things going on in our waters that we believe need some investigation.
Kiralee, the transfer of pressure from demersal is likely to go on to pelagic, and that's been the recommendation over the years when we've had conversations about demersal fish. Are you comfortable with the amount of knowledge about pelagic stocks that exists at the moment?
So there has been a number of reports tabled, not just the demersal scale fish assessment report. There has been a number of assessment reports, and some of those are quite dated. So again, that's why we're asking for an inquiry. Let's see what resources are needed to be placed into fisheries management to ensure that we do have the most up-to-date science so we can be informed around making these decisions. We think that's really important, and we're certainly hearing that from the industry themselves and those people that have been impacted. And when I say industry, it's fishing families. It's families that just enjoy fishing as a hobby and a recreational thing that they like to do. And all of those people that are employed in the fishing industry, such as fishmongers and processors, right down to the fish and chip shop and the tourism operators in our regional communities, these are the ones that are reeling from these announcements and are really feeling the impact.
I have had conversations with fishers where they have talked about examining their legal options. Are you hearing anything in that space?
That would be a decision for those businesses themselves, and certainly we are trying to support the industry and the fishers wherever we can, in the sense of providing them information if we have that, and just being that listening ear for them, but also encouraging them to sign the petition that we've got going to be calling on this inquiry. In terms of a class action, I would say that is something for individuals and business operators to make consideration on.
We are at the wharf at Geraldton and the boat lifter is going past, so that is the noise in the background, but hopefully we'll be okay. Kiralee, going beyond the West Coast demersal zone, that's Kalbarri to Augusta, looking at the communities, the regional centres that particularly exist on the edge of that zone, are you concerned about the fishing pressure that will come in from a recreational perspective into those communities that neighbour the zone?
Yeah, that is a question that we have asked the Minister. We have penned that to her, and we are seeking what that will mean in terms of fishery management in those regions that remain open. And we are certainly hearing from those communities. We have been hearing from those communities for some time, and in particular local governments, who often have to deal with the increased intake of people into their communities, providing those facilities, whether that's the fish cleaning tables and the offal bins and then the removal of that offal. And they are certainly saying, where are we included in the consultation around this? How are we to know what is going to be the impact in our communities because of these wide sweeping announcements?
And Shark Bay in particular, there is a concern there within a lot of people in that community. They say that the boat car park is already full. Should there be tougher restrictions on bag limits in those communities that neighbour the West Coast demersal zone?
I simply say let's have an inquiry into fisheries. Let's understand what's going on across our whole West Australian coastline within our biocatch regions, however that is. Let's get some science. Let's understand all of the impacts around fishing, and then I think we can make some better informed decisions.
Right amongst the action there. That was opposition fisheries spokesperson Kiralee Waugh speaking to Joe Prendergast. And we have put in a request for an interview with the state fisheries minister, Jackie Jarvis. Hopefully you will hear from her tomorrow. 11-1. Well, Haywire winner Justice has never met anyone with the same story as her. When Cyclone Seroja came through her hometown of Perenjori, Justice didn't think the storm would literally change how she saw the world. But years later, she still doesn't know why she can't see the world as she once did. This is her story.
Haywire! Stories of life in regional Australia.
Justice, Perenjori, Western Australia, Badimaya Country.
It sounded like all the windows were cracking, but they weren't. It was April 2021 when Cyclone Seroja swept through Perenjori. Mum, my sister and I slept in the hallway, the most stable part of the house. I remember hearing sheets of metal grating across bitumen, crashing through the fence, the sound of our neighbour's roof coming off. When the police told us it was safe to leave our house, we walked through the town. The tin roof of the pub was everywhere along the train tracks. It was quite a sight. I thought the damage would be limited to shattered buildings and uprooted trees. I never imagined it would have a physiological impact too. 2 days after the storm, when I woke up, it was black in my left eye. It was like my eye was closed, but it was open. It felt like the world I had always seen, vibrant and clear, had become empty and dark. I travelled to the Lions Eye Institute in Perth, feeling anxious for what was going to come next. The specialists ran tests, electrophysiology, with strange flashing lights and electrodes that felt like lashes against my eyes. I'd do the eye tests where I cover my right eye and the optometrist would say, "What can you see?" I'd say, "I can't see anything. I can't tell you what's in front of me." They just kept asking and I kept not being able to see anything. Each appointment left me frustrated as doctors scribbled notes linking my vision loss to trauma, offering no clear explanation. I kept hoping it was temporary, a problem that would pass, but the darkness stayed. I just wanted to know why I could no longer see the world as I once had. The hardest part wasn't losing sight, it was everything that followed. Headaches became my constant companion, sharp and persistent. My peers typed essays and scrolled through screens effortlessly, while devices left me dizzy, in pain, and exhausted. I couldn't keep up, not because I wasn't trying, but because my body wouldn't let me. I've learnt that strength isn't always about winning. It's showing up, even when it feels harder than it should. I manage with one eye, adapting every day. The storm outside passed years ago, but the one inside shaped me into someone stronger.
abc.net.au/haywire.
Justice from Perenjori, WA, with her Haywire winning story. And we understand Justice is going through a bit of a hard time right now, so our best thoughts are with her. And in January, Justice and the other winners will be travelling to Canberra for the Haywire Regional Youth Summit. If you want to read more of her story and the stories of all the other Haywire winners, you can do so online by searching ABC and Haywire. And Haywire is spelled HEYWIRE. Well, a Victoria-based company is planning on producing steel in the heart of the Pilbara's iron ore region, and they think they can do it in an energy-efficient way. For the past 3 years, Metal Logic has been developing what they're calling a scalable, modular platform, allowing them to produce clean steel. Joe Nichols is the managing director of the group behind the project, and he says they've recently secured land in Port Hedland for the facility, which is a significant step forward.
With this clean steel project, we're looking to demonstrate a unique process enables us to process any grade of ore and any type of ore through to a crude steel, not green iron product. What we're able to do is deliver a modular setup. That modular setup means that we produce these modules in smaller sizes that can be delivered to site and scale to any size that's required to deliver a crude steel solution. That crude steel solution will ultimately be sold in the first instance to feed into things like rebar facilities.
So when you say modular, are you talking about like when you build a modular home, it kind of comes pre-made in a factory and can just put on the back of a truck and install it quite easily? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, that's correct. We'll produce prefabricated modules that are taken to site and then can be implemented to produce crude steel.
We have heard of other companies trying to make green iron a reality. How is this different?
This process is very much focused on thermodynamics and thermal efficiency. In simple terms, what that means is we require less energy per unit of output. By focusing on that, it means that we've been able to focus on continuous process that enables us to get to a clean steel product that is a zero emission product as well.
Most emissions that come from the steel making process, you know, when you put iron ore and coal into a furnace and apply huge amounts of heat, it's a really energy intensive process. How are you planning on doing that without using coal?
So we're using an energy source that we won't disclose at this point in time. It allows us to deliver greater energy density and, as I mentioned earlier, better thermal efficiency, which means that we have less waste in the process. And also there are zero to very, very low carbon dioxide emissions.
When will you be ready to sort of go public with that information?
In the next 6 months, as we start to produce from our first modules for the million tonne per annum setup that we're looking to take up to the Pilbara. We're more than happy to start talking about it at that point in time.
What's sort of the next step in all of this? You've got the land.
So the next steps are we've commenced production of the million tonne per annum smelter. We expect to have the first of those modules operational within the next six months, and then we look to scale that beyond there with the modular production line that we have.
And this may be a little bit too early for this question, but I suppose if everything does go to plan and you are making this green steel, will you be exporting it or selling it locally? What's sort of the plan?
We haven't got to that point, Georgia. I mean, we're talking with some Asian users of steel that would like to feed this into their rebar facilities. There's obviously been some announcements in Western Australia recently around using locally sourced steel, and obviously the Cook government's green iron and green steel policy. So that's certainly something that we'll look to broach as we move into the next calendar year.
Metallogic Managing Director Joel Nichols, talking to Georgia Hargreaves about the company's plans to be smelting iron ore in the Pilbara. 3 minutes to one. Well, the Katanning Sale Yards hosted its second last sheep sale for the year today, and it was quite a big one. Tracy Kilner, all up about 22,000 sheep and lambs sold. Could you please run me through all the details?
Vendors were keen to clear stocks for our second last sale of the year, with numbers up 4,938 from last week. Mutton dominated the yarding with large volume lines on offer. Mutton trended up with a pen of merino ewes reaching a high of $260 a head. The lamb yarding was dominated by lightweights and unfinished lambs, with limited numbers of prime lambs, which trended up to firm with an extra heavy weight pen reaching $350. The new season lambs weighing under 16 kilos carcass weight sold from 125 to 180. The heavier lambs made from 170 to $220 a head. Trade weight lambs made from 190 to 248, and the heavyweight sold from 250 up to $350 a head. Ram lambs sold to processors for 108 to $170. The merino hoggets saw the store weathers range from 72 to 180, while medium and heavyweight sold from 170 to $230 a head. Merino ewe hoggets returned from 90 up to $180 to restockers for the lightweight store ewes, while medium and heavyweights made from 160 up to $249, again to a restocker buyer. Store mutton sold from 51 for very light ewes up to $201 a head. Prime medium weight ewes returned from 160 to 230, and the heavyweight ewes over 30 kilos carcass weight sold from $200 to $260 a head. Mature store wethers made from 130 to 170, while medium and heavyweight sold from 180 up to $250 a head. Mature rams sold from 70 up to $280 for a pen of crossbred rams to a restocker. This has been Tracy Kilner for Meat and Livestock Australia's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thank you, Tracy. And that's it from me on the Country Hour this afternoon. I'll leave you alone until tomorrow at 12 o'clock. It's news time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.